The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
That's right, it's Thursday, December 9th, 2010. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable dollar lunch district of New York City. Got another great program for you today, folks. I am well rested, despite the fact I have to do something about this. You know, I generally, what I do when I go home at night is I play with my daughter. Sometimes I make dinner. Sometimes I clean up after dinner. Sometimes I put my daughter to bed. And then I let Nikki yell at me for 25 minutes because I left the sock on the floor, which apparently is a real problem. I guess it's a danger to everyone in the house, in the apartment, if I have a sock on the floor. But that's not the point. So last night, in addition to putting together a membership email, which I think actually should be hitting your email boxes now. If you have become a member, you have received a special email from the desk of Cedar. And it starts to tell you how you can acquire your goodies. And one of the best goodies is that Bush pardon video. But we can talk more about that later. And, of course, it has a link to Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop, where you get a 10% discount using the coupon code MAJORITY. So I worked on that, and then I watched Lawrence O'Donnell's show. I mean, you know, I was watching Olbermann, too, and Rachel, and, you know, I'm fast-forwarding, going backwards. You know, some stories I've already covered, some stories I didn't know about, some stories I know I've heard too much about. And I get to O'Donnell, and he has another really interesting panel on, talking about the tax deal. And I'll tell you, you know, there's something about O'Donnell, you know, and O'Donnell and I used to argue on the old Majority Report, and I would have him on Sam Cedar's show about certain things. And I don't know if I can watch that show before I go to bed, because I try and go to sleep, and all I'm doing is having an argument in my head with him over and over again. And we're going to talk more about this this tax deal with Chris Hayes, but the way it breaks down is, I think, ultimately, is a question of policy, and I don't want to say politics, because that implies, when you just say politics, it implies some type of partisan bickering and posturing and whatnot. Politics, in my estimation, is policy plus time. Because we can pick, you know, I think it's clear that the economy needs stimulation, that this tax deal provides stimulus that possibly may not otherwise be able to be achieved. Let's even stipulate for a moment that you cannot achieve that stimulus, at least in the near term, in the next 6 months, because of the nature of the political realities. And also from a policy perspective, as Lawrence O'Donnell, you know, like, I listened to the podcast, I'm like, why do I keep referencing O'Donnell? It's like he's not even my bete noir. I haven't settled on one yet. I think it's between Dorsey and O'Donnell. So, and it is true that if you are a family making under $40,000, your income taxes go up by 50%. In real terms, the worst case scenario that is, and I'm not belittling at all. Believe me, I understand the implications of an additional $200 a month. But it's unlikely that it's even that high. But, you know, $100 a month, if you are making $40,000 a year for a family of four before taxes, that's a big deal, $100 a month. That's a big deal. So I'm not diminishing that in any way. But those are the policy implications in the short term. A general stimulus for the economy. Unemployment benefits, yes, but not for everyone who needs it. And probably not for those who need it the most, which is the people who are getting off unemployment after 99 weeks. But is there value? I mean, you're weighing that against the implication that in a year when all this stuff goes away, which it will, all the benefits of this will go away, I guess except for that tax cut for the middle class, against capitulating at this time to the Republicans, against defining the political reality in such a way that they can hold you hostage a year down the road, not to mention what we talked about yesterday, which we'll talk about with Chris Hayes. I don't know if he's dug into this at all, but that Buy America Bonds program, there's a lot more to it than the policy in a vacuum. And that is very often the argument between so-called liberal activists or Netroots people or in the liberal establishment. And we will talk to Chris Hayes about that. We may mention, but I certainly... And if folks out there, if you know of a good writer on this topic, I've been trying to follow the WikiLeaks stuff. Now, Greenwald is fantastic on talking about the implications of WikiLeaks, and you know maybe we'll try and get Greenwald on. I listened to a great interview with him on Brian Lehr, and Glenn Greenwald has posted it on his blog. So it's best to listen to it there just because he isolates it. And, you know, Brian Lehr drives me up a wall, frankly. Classic sort of case of an NPR person who's ostensibly or perceived as liberal, but he very well may be in some regards, but a total sort of establishment, you know, this is a guy who really he's good at radio. But, I mean, I just remember being interviewed him about Air America, and he asked me this sort of, like, very a ridiculous question. I mean, the whole interview was ridiculous, but he said something to the effect of, like, why is it? Now, this is a radio guy, right, who's been in radio for, what, 10, 20 years? Who knows? Why is it we hear so much in New York about, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, but when Air America was on, we never heard anything about them? Well, guy who's been in radio for 20 years, and, you know, it was me and Anna Marie Cox on. Now, God bless Anna Marie Cox. She doesn't know anything about radio. Me, personally, I barely know anything about radio, you know, because I was a newbie. I had no radio experience the moment that I started doing Air America, short of, like, one stint, one night on FMU for 2 hours, and then college radio. Which was pretty much a disaster. I think I played Coffee in Bed by Squeeze at the wrong speed. I mean, honestly, that was my radio experience. Now, why might WABC in New York City get better ratings than WRL? Can either one of you two radio gurus answer that question? Oh my God! You must be a genius. Anybody in radio, that's the first thing that they would tell you. At WABC, you can hear literally hundred, maybe 1,000 miles from. I mean, it's a 50,000 watt superstation that signal is. And WRL, you cannot. As soon as it starts to get. Sort of, you know, at dusk at 4:30, they turn the thing down. I mean, never mind during the day, it's pretty weak. I think during the day you can reach it if you're, you know, you're just south in like the South Bronx. ABC, you could probably reach like somewhere in Ohio. But be that as it may, it's a great interview. But I'm looking for what's happening now with WikiLeaks, which is so fascinating to me, is that Anonymous. Is there another name for Anonymous?
The organization?
Yes.
I think they're just referring to themselves as Anonymous.
These are the people who sort of launched a cyber... It's so weird to use that term at this point. But an online campaign against Scientology, where they released interviews and some documents, I think, like that. And now what has been happening with WikiLeaks is sort of extrajudicial. Put aside for a moment the questions as to whether or not it is typical of Interpol to react so quickly to rape charges in Sweden to get somebody in Britain. It's quite possible it is. I don't know. I'm not going to, you know, imply that there's anything nefarious going on there because I don't know. And we hear all the time of different instances where, you know, certain charges are moved to the front of the line. Nobody's ever been charged by a U.S. Attorney in the history of America, as far as I know, for being a John, like Elliot Spitzer was hounded in that way. So put that aside. What the U.S. government has been doing in terms of intimidating online companies and places like MasterCard and Visa and PayPal, who are simply collection points for people who want to donate money to WikiLeaks, not to Julian Assange, but to the organization. The U.S. government had WikiLeaks shut down. There, you know, I can't. And we reported like a week or two ago that the Department of Homeland Security shut down 70 sites without anything other than on the basis of complaints about copyright. So there's... This is all extrajudicial. At this point, Julian Assange has not been charged with anything in the United States, at least not in a public indictment. There could be sealed indictments. But... So you have this sort of extrajudicial war going on online, an information war, and this organization Anonymous has struck back by essentially with a denial of service. Now this is Evan where you're gonna have to step in and help me because I don't understand any of this stuff, but they basically shut down MasterCard and Visa sites last night by just like pinging the site repeatedly from multiple entrance points, shutting down, just overloading their servers. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Sites can only take so much traffic, and if the traffic overloads, then it crashes the server that it's run on. So the easiest way to attack a site is to visit it millions of times in a very short period of time.
And no, it's not one guy sitting there going, refresh, refresh, refresh,
right,
refresh,
right, right, right.
Refresh, 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 you know.
I think what they were
like
doing.
Like I've tried to do on all the online votes for me for anything.
Right, right. It's like they've been distributing programs, botnets, that essentially make networks of computers able to do all of these things at once, and people have been downloading this.
So there, this has been like sort of a crowdsourced attack. And they were going to do this with PayPal, but PayPal basically has come out and released the money that they had collected for Julian Assange. My understanding, they're also talking about attacking Amazon very shortly. Because Amazon, removed their they didn't allow for their service
on their...
Yeah, they
pulled their server space from WikiLeaks.
So this is fascinating, and I'm going to try and find somebody who can talk about this element of it, because, you know, this is real. I mean, this is real insofar as, you know, it's always something sort of sci-fi quality about what's going to happen with Big Brother and... what's his face? Gibson, right?
William Gibson, yes.
Yes. And what's his face? Gibson. That's probably not the best way to... William Gibson. And he's the guy who wrote like Minority Report, right? Now, didn't he write that? Or
That was Philip K. Dick.
Oh, right, yeah. Philip K. Dick. No, what Gibson wrote?
Neuromancer.
Right.
One of them.
I read one of, but you know, it's all sort of like, it's sort of Brave New World without Dallas Huxley understanding, like, you know, it's all going to be online at that point.
Yeah, yeah, it's like an online dystopia kind of.
It is the sort of the next battleground, and because people, it's still a world in which the vast majority of people don't really understand what's going on, that governments can run amok there. And it's also why it's so important that certain net neutrality and whatnot is resolved in ways that, at least don't allow them a leg up on this type of censure. I mean, it's what it is. It's just censoring. But maybe we'll touch on it with Chris Hayes, because Chris Hayes is very smart and thoughtful about all this stuff. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Chris Hayes of Washington editor of The Nation magazine and, of course, MSNBC contributor and frequent host of Olbermann and Maddow. I don't know. He probably does other things in his spare time, I would imagine. He's writing a book, I think, too. We'll talk to him about all that in just a moment. And that's it. We'll be right back. We are back on the Majority Report on the computer. On the phone-ish, is Chris Hayes. He is the editor, the Washington editor of The Nation magazine, MSNBC contributor, frequent guest host, and also writing a book. Is that right?
That's correct. Solely but surely.
I'm sorry. I'll put that up. And with breaking news. Hold on for 1 second. I don't think you can hear that. You can't hear the... Okay, I just gave you the breaking news 360 lead.
Did you have a sound? You guys have
a
breaking news?
Yeah, we haven't quite figured out. We haven't worked out all the tech stuff so that you can actually hear what we're doing here.
I'm imagining. I love breaking news sounders, so I like it being left to my imagination.
It was good. It's about as good as it gets. we're going to talk about the tax deal, and you and I were just – I was just asking you if you knew anything about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You said, well, this is going to be affected by this breaking news. And so let's hear it.
So a Hill source who is in the House caucus, Democratic caucus, just had a meeting, and they were discussing the tax cut deal, and a Hill source emailed, I believe, someone at Politico to say that the House Democratic caucus had rejected the tax deal in their internal caucus meeting. Now, that's a pretty big deal and a pretty big rebuke. Now, a few things can happen out of this. The president goes back and twists arms and basically calls up and meets with and harangues various members of the House Democratic Caucus who change their mind and pass it as is.
But we all know that the president doesn't have that ability. The president doesn't have the ability to do that because he would have been able to do that for other things. He doesn't have the ability to change, right? I mean, or
he only has that ability with progressive members of Congress.
Oh, okay, right, okay.
See, it's a limited superpower.
Right.
It only acts on progressive members of Congress. So he could twist arms, and you know, maybe they'll come around. They can sweeten, you know, change the deal in certain ways, perhaps add in, tie it to a raising of the debt ceiling, which I think a lot of progressives that I've been reading have very smartly said is a key feature of this deal. Otherwise, you know, we can expect a showdown that's going to cause massive austerity in 3 months. Alternately, there might be some procedural means by which the House could actually bring it to a floor for a vote. The votes are probably there for passage, even if a majority of the Democratic caucus doesn't support it, because I think Boehner would be able to get most Republicans on board.
So, all right, now let's go. Let's back up here for a second.
Yeah.
you know, from what I've read, the real issue here is, and tell me if you subscribe to this notion in terms of the tax deal, is that from a policy standpoint, in a vacuum,
yep,
in a vacuum, that this is a pretty good deal.
Yep.
Insofar
yep.
as it adds needed stimulus that nobody anticipated would be available. But that there are but that policy doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Right.
And that if you look upon politics as policy plus time, there could be a problem down the road. You mentioned the debt ceiling because there are Republicans. Because one, if you capitulate in this regard, I mean, if you basically say we are the ones to be responsible about, like, not letting the unemployed end up on the streets, not raising taxes on people making very little money at a time when they're severely pinched and we have a
yep.
housing crisis. If you're the responsible one, then you got to be the responsible one when it comes time to raise the debt ceiling, because if the debt ceiling's not raised and we have to default on our debt, it's literally the financial apocalypse.
Yes.
Once you say to that person that, like, I'm going to cave under this situation, you're going to have to cave under all those situations.
Yeah, I think that framework is pretty much exactly where I'm feeling, which is that, you know, if you look at the sort of people who evaluate the sort of economic policy lens, and even people like, you know, Dean Baker, who is certainly no apologist for the Obama administration, and not a wishy-washy, you know, neoliberal centrist. I mean, I respect his politics. You know, he says, hey, this is good stimulus. Even money for the rich. I mean, if you're viewing this through a purely Keynesian, and I had this conversation with my editor, right? If you're viewing this purely Keynesian, right, and you have a universe A in which there's no money for the rich, right? There's no tax cuts for the rich. And universe B in which there's, you know, whatever it is, $100 billion tax cuts for the rich. There's actually more stimulus in universe B. The question is,
right.
How effective is it? It's not very effective, according
right.
to CBO.
It estimate. Could be worth, I mean, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but you could give them $100 billion, and maybe it has the effect of a $10 billion stimulus, but that's more than zero.
That's $10 billion more than zero, right? So from the policy perspective, I understand why, basically, I think that sort of, you know, think tank economists, sort of left-to-center technocrats have viewed this as a win. But I think you're exactly right about what the power and political dynamic is. And I think, you know, the negotiating with hostages metaphor is apt because it embodies this time sequencing problem, which is that in the moment of negotiating with someone over a hostage, you want to negotiate because you want to save the life. But if you save the life, you create incentives in the future for future hostage taking, which is why the official. But I think a less dramatic the metaphor I've used in the previous essay and used here is a protection racket, right? I mean, if you're operating in a neighborhood with a mob protection racket that basically terrorizes the small business owners and demands a protection fee, right? And you come into this neighborhood as a parish priest or a social worker, and you get a grant for money, okay? And you can go and you can actually pay the premium of the protection racket fee for the nail salons and the bodegas and the small businesses in the neighborhood. There's no question you would massively improve the lives of those small business owners. You would take this burden away from them. But you would also be fundamentally acknowledging the legitimacy of the protection racket and further empowering it and entrenching it as an institution in the neighborhood. And I don't think it's an easy paradox, right?
Because you use this in probably my favorite article in the past 3 years, System Failure, right?
Yes,
the healthcare battle. And,
right.
and you were describing the idea of the public option and why progressives were so upset about it. And,
yep.
and in that instance, the protection racket was the private insurance industry, if I remember correctly.
Yes. Yeah, and pharma. Let's not remember the big pharma deal, which
right.
basically took off the table, you know, bulk negotiation on prescription drugs, which, of course, similarly to the repeal of the Bush tax cuts, was a central Democratic plank. It wasn't
right.
some, like, lefty, you know, pie in the sky single payer thing that you and I want. But,
right.
you know, this was a thing that Democratic candidates up and down the line across the spectrum repealed Bush tax cuts, negotiating Medicare
right.
drug prices. These were standard planks. Right.
And so now we're left in this situation, and I would say that, you know, on some level, the immediate problem of legitimizing this protection racket is even more distinct and pronounced in terms of negotiating with the Republicans in this manner.
Because, and I think,
because we're not talking about some overall systemic type of situation. We're talking about something that actually has implications 3 weeks from now when the, a month from now when the Republicans take over office. And there's no disincentive for them not to just chop away at that stimulus as it exists now. And in other words, they could. All of this is predicated. The benefits of this stimulus are all predicated on the notion that this does not empower Republicans to destimulate the economy by starting to cut and to use things like this tax holiday from Social Security, which is now sort of making a deeper connection, even though it's being paid off by the general fund. It's making a more one-to-one connection between Social Security and the deficit. You are now basically enabling them not just to take hostages in the future, but to make a more but to actually just start to hack away at the actual hostages.
That's right. And I think I think for people that, you know, Ezra Klein, who has been very positive on this deal, had a line about, you know, the sort of huge blind spot about not tying this to a debt ceiling, you know, because that's the big hostage, right? That's the thing they're clearly gearing up to do. And he had a line which I thought was important, which is not every ransom needs to be paid. And I think if you say the logic of this is it's the best deal they can get, you can't, we can't allow the unemployed. And again, I don't think this is a ludicrous notion at all. The people that are defending the deal on those terms, but then I think you do have to say there has to be some line, right? I mean, we could, there's a reductio ad absurdum here where it's like at a certain point, it's like, okay, we will extend unemployment next year, right? Because we're going to have the same issue next year because unemployment's going to be very high. People are about to get kicked off if you privatize Social Security. Well, okay, that's not – I think everyone would say, no, that's a bridge too far. And the question is, what is a bridge too far?
Are you sure about that?
Well, I'm saying for myself.
Right.
I'm saying for myself.
Right.
I'm saying that you have to – if the logic by which you defend this deal is this logic of essentially operating under these conditions of the protection racket and hostage taking, choose your metaphor, there has to be some point at which the payoff demanded by the protection racket is too high.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, and I would say there's a distinction between healthcare and this for this reason. I really do think, and I was persuaded during the run-up to healthcare, that if you looked at the history of healthcare reform, successive Democratic presidents had tried to pass it and it had gotten less and less progressive with each iteration. And that there was a window to pass it. And this was not just the best deal we're going to get in that moment, the best deal we're going to get for the long foreseeable future. Okay. In this case, if there's one thing the United States Congress knows how to do, it's cut taxes. I'm not concerned necessarily if the tax cuts lapse here and you actually do call the bluff and you do essentially take this sort of like, this position where we won't pay the protection fee this time, you know,
that point that you're making here, like the idea that it would be very hard for Obama to, because that's all we're talking about. We're talking about unemployment benefits and then just a series of tax cuts.
Some of which are quite good and some of which are not.
But I mean, the idea that it would be hard for Obama to sell a package of tax cuts to a Republican Congress in 6 months is fantastical. The issue is that he wouldn't get the political credit for it, which I think it's deluded to think that he's going to get the political credit for it anyways. But so what we're really talking about is unemployment benefits here. And, you know, the debt ceiling thing, again, seriously? Let that Republican who will be enshrined in the history of the United States, who is the one who's going to filibuster raising the debt ceiling.
And let me say this about the debt ceiling, just a little discursive tangent here. You know, I have a podcast called The Breakdown. It's 10, 15 minutes a week. We take one question from the internet. People have a question. We find someone to answer it, and we try to explain it. And someone asked about this debt ceiling thing. What's the deal? And I had Dean Baker on. And Dean Baker made this very good point. He basically said, look, the dynamics are similar to TARP, right? Let's remember, every Republican and right winger and free marketeer was against TARP, and they actually voted it down the first time. And what happened? The Chamber of Commerce, the Financial Services Roundtable, Goldman Sachs, and basically the investor class that funds the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, definitely the Republican Party, went up and down Rayburn and Cannon House office buildings, waterboarding every single member of the Republican caucus that voted against it. And sure enough, they changed their mind. They voted for it. The point is that not raising the debt ceiling would be intolerable to Wall Street. And so I think Nancy Pelosi, this is what I would love to see. I would love to see Nancy Pelosi say to John Boehner, John, we've heard the message America sent. We have too much debt we're putting on our grandchildren. We've heard the message loud and clear. Not one single member of my caucus will vote to raise the debt ceiling.
Right.
And then say to John Boehner, you know what? You go find the votes. You're in charge.
You're the Speaker of the House. It is your debt ceiling to raise. It's not ours.
Exactly.
And it's impossible to imagine.
They would have to break. It's impossible to imagine they wouldn't do it
because they would be literally, that would be the end of the Republican Party. It would, people talk about, was there really a financial crisis that we were being held hostage, we shouldn't give money to the bank? All that's out the window. You default on the debt. Forget it.
I should note that there's a little bit of wiggle room in that, as Baker pointed out, the deadline's a little fungible. Treasury can actually do things it's going to come up in two years. But it's right. Eventually it's going to happen, right? Eventually you're going to have to raise the debt ceiling. And I think I would really like to see that, take that position.
Right. That's why this, as far as I'm concerned, the issue in this tax deal should not be the debt ceiling. It should be something more along the lines of, we want 2 years of unemployment and forget about the, make the, it's, instead of it being a payroll tax holiday or deduct, reduction, let's just do send stimulus checks. If that's really what you want to do. And because, look, the chances of that holiday, and we've talked about it on this show, and, I assume that your perspective on this, too, is that it's going to be very hard to re-raise that payroll tax.
Oh, my God. And they're going to are you kidding? They will demagogue the holy hell out of this.
As soon as this thing expires.
Hold on for 1 second. My voice sounds awful.
As soon as this thing expires, right? I had dinner with a conservative sort of movement, conservative activist guy, writer last night. And he said, of course we're going to oppose a tax hike when the payroll tax expires. Of course. Now you're taking out, in the Jenga tower that is Social Security, now you're removing some blocks from the bottom, right?
FDR said, this is why I have a payroll tax, so that everybody can pay into it and it's theirs. But once you start to remove that relationship to Social Security, that was ridiculous.
And I agree on the stimulus checks because, one of the big arguments, and let me make two quick substance points. One of the big arguments about the way they did the tax breaks in the first recession and the first Recovery Act, right? Michael Cooper wrote a great piece on this in the New York Times. No one knows they got a tax break, right? And the reason is, very smartly, and I think to the credit of the economists, in the White House, they started taking it immediately off people's payroll taxes so that the money would get out immediately. You wouldn't have to wait to April to get the check or March whenever you file your taxes, right? But it's unclear how effective that was and how much more effective. I think in this case, I would much rather see a check sent to everyone when they filed their taxes that said the Barack Obama paid tax cut, Democratic Party, and Barack Obama, which is what Bush did. Remember, everyone got a check from the IRS that said, thanks to the passage of the blah, 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 signed into law by George W. Bush, this is the tax cut you get, and it was a check. Okay, I'd like to see that. Second of all, the underlying problem here for any stimulus that goes to the economy is the amount of bad debt households are carrying. We are still in a tremendous deleveraging process. And so what happens is that the stimulative effects of the money that flows into households is going to pay off creditors on bad debt. You have to attack the problem at its root. It's what we learned from Japan. It's what we've learned from other financial crises, which is that you have to go after the bad debt and write down the bad debt, cancel some of the bad debt, and deleverage that way. Otherwise, you will constantly be sort of climbing uphill, running against a treadmill.
Right. So just so people understand what you're saying here is that it is not stimulative for me to pay off my credit card because I'm not buying anything new that creates any other jobs. Maybe at best case scenario, I am maybe just adding a couple of hours to the phone call center that is, frankly, in probably not even in this country at this point.
Right.
And it's not stimulated at all. And we're not even really talking about credit card debt as much as we are about talking about this massive foreclosure problem. And
that's
this
right.
This is something that could have been resolved through the judicial system with the executive branch basically pushing for the cram down. Which would have allowed bankruptcy judges to actually reduce the principal owed on these homes. Everybody takes a haircut. That's what happens when you have bad loans. Banks do that all the time in good times and bad times.
Yep.
But they wanted to, I don't know. I don't know why they didn't push that, because they were weak at that time. Let me ask you about one more thing that is really concerning to me. That, and I haven't seen anywhere other than Digby repeating it from Naked Capitalism, based on a Reuters alert or something about this Buy America Bonds program. Are you familiar with this at all?
I followed it in the periphery, and I know there was a lot of there was a little controversy over it.
The one thing that that Reuters reported. And, you know, we don't have to go into it too much if you don't know anything about it, but that the Buy American Bonds program is this program that was, I think, part of the stimulus. I'm not sure where it was established, but it subsidized, essentially, the interest payments that states and municipalities have to offer bondholders by 35%. And the idea is that this is coming up. This is one of those programs that's going to end on December 31st. And we have less property taxes going in. We have less revenues for states and municipalities. And that apparently, you know, according to this guy, Jim Pithakoukas, forgive me for butchering his name, of Reuters, this is what the Republicans are very excited about. Because once the subsidies for essentially allowing states and municipalities to operate and meet their budget requirements is gone, then there's talk of forcing states like California, Illinois, probably some municipalities, maybe some other entities into bankruptcy and allowing them to cancel their contracts with unions of governmental workers, which, you know, we've been seeing without really a clear agenda other than just sort of whipping up anti-government sentiment by the right wing for months and months and months now, a concerted effort across ranging from Grover Norquist to Glenn Beck to Limbaugh, attacks on these government workers. And there's some concern that in letting this lapse, this is going, you know, this is another way for the Republicans to say, like, not our problem.
Yep.
And Digby tied this into Peter Orszag's comments on the Deficit Commission that we may need, like, some defaults by some state, some local governments, state and municipalities to really get this deficit stuff committed. I'm concerned that this is basically the prelude to cutting Social Security, among other things.
Well, I think your concern is right. I mean, I think when you talk about where is the anti-stimulus going to come from, it's going to come from the states. It's already been coming from the states. In fact, it's been eating into a lot of the stimulus from the Recovery Act. The two things that are sort of overhanging is all this bad debt that people have, credit card bills, underwater on their homes, student loans, tons of debt that's held by households. That means they can't sort of consume and push out the productive capacity of the economy, and the state budget deficits that are causing pro-cyclical, which is to say, you know, recessionary cuts, austerity measures at a moment when you want expansionary measures at the state level. That is where things get really terrifying when the Recovery Act, and you're totally right, you know, runs out. And that's where the really nasty and brutish political battles will be. I should note one thing. My understanding is that legally, it is impossible for a state to go into bankruptcy. State cannot be bankrupt as a matter of law. Municipalities can be. And municipalities have. Orange County declared bankruptcy at a certain point. New York, of course, famously. So, but what you are going to see are these really brutal and brutal austerity fights in which basically, not to use too coarse a term, the ruling class is going to stick it to its list of class enemies that it can use this sort of crisis to stick it to. And that's going to be ugly. And that's not only just going to be ugly from a distributional perspective in terms of who wins and who loses when the pressure of austerity comes down and squeezes down, right? The weakest pillars are the ones that are crushed. It's also going to be bad in terms of just a general technocratic macroeconomic sense of eating into the stimulative effects of anything that gets passed at the federal level.
Right. Right. And so, you know, you can talk about, and, you know, I keep referencing O'Donnell because I leave my TV on MSNBC. He comes on, then and I get upset and I can't sleep. But you can talk about that in the short run, you know, people who are families that are making $40,000 would be faced alternatively with a, you know, a $2,000 a year bump in their income taxes, or more or less, probably a little bit less, actually. But the bottom line is that by the time the implications of this hits the states, you know, if you're not getting any political leverage with the Republicans when they're about to take over the House, and you don't have anything to trade them in any way, or force them to pick up some of the slack, force them to be accountable to the American public, force them to look at Ohio and say, we're the ones who wouldn't let your unemployment, give you unemployment. If you don't let them take ownership of this in any way, there's every reason to believe that person who gets who doesn't get that $2,000 a year bump in their income taxes is going to end up paying for it twice over in some other way.
Yes. No, I agree. I mean, I am generally in agreement with that. And it's very worrisome. I mean, I'm not, you know, I do think, you know, I understand why in some ways inside the White House they're celebrating, because I think they do think they're getting more. And I do think, to be honest, I think the White House right at this point is not in particularly long view mode.
Right.
I mean, I think, and I understand. I mean, I think there is panic within the White House economic team because they see 9.8% unemployment. And the path from here to, say, 7% and dropping, that's probably necessary for re-election in 2012, is a very, very, very unclear path.
And, you know, Krugman had I think it was a blog post today where he basically said, you know, Larry Mischel has taught me that, you know, it's not a question of where unemployment is at, it's where it's trending. And
exactly.
He said that all of the stimulus that's involved in this package basically works for the first year. But then by the time you get to 2012, it starts to creep back up again, and you start to have another problem. And this is without even calculating what the Republicans are willing to do to put the economy in the shitter going into 2012. And so he thinks that if you take even a slightly longer view from a political standpoint, never mind what it sets the Republicans up to do worse, that even as it stands on these terms, you're screwing yourself electorally.
Well, I think it's likely right. I mean, look, it's hard. You know, economic predictions have been proven faulty in a million different directions. So I retain a hope. You know, there have been other times in American life when it looked like, you know, the American economy had sort of run out of gas.
We could get into a really big war, and that could be.
Or we can find some, you know, we can find some massive speculative bubble, which I think is actually the sort of more probable. I mean, the problem is if the speculative bubbles in commodities, that actually will be bad because it'll drag down growth. But that's another story. But we can find some other speculative bubble. And at this point, you would be praying for a speculative bubble if you were in the White House.
Maybe there'll be some type of huge bubble in some type of program that censors websites online or something.
That's right. Yes,
but,
exactly. All right.
Well, look, I want to just touch on one or two things. I've held you longer than I said I would. And I know you've got work to do. But what is your take on this whole WikiLeaks thing? Not so much on the Assange thing, but I think what's happening, because I know you're sort of like a techno geek on some level, and I mean, have you been following what is happening in terms of these anonymous? I'm just curious.
Yeah.
So
this will be my closing comment, because then I have to run again.
Yes, I understand.
Give a talk. But a few things. One is that everyone should rent Sneakers, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, and the Ben Kingsley character has this sort of striking similarity. He's an ex-hacker turned sort of activist, radical code breaker, and the watch line of the movie is "Too Many Secrets." And the Ben Kingsley delivers a monologue in that movie that literally could be right out of Julian Assange's mouth. So everyone should rent that. They should also, there's an essay floating around that sort of outlines Assange's worldview, which I think is a sort of good window to this. I think here's what I would say generally about the WikiLeaks phenomenon and what we've seen, particularly with regards to calls for prosecution, Visa and MasterCard, now Twitter essentially censoring. Right. WikiLeaks, it is very hard to come up with a decision procedure whereby Visa and MasterCard can do that to WikiLeaks and they can't do it to The Nation magazine. WikiLeaks is fundamentally a journalistic enterprise. They have not been charged with any crime, and it's very hard to see how they could be charged with any crime. And any prior restraint, which is attack denial of service attacks by foreign governments, robbing them of the basic mechanisms to pay the bills, fundraise, do all the things that all other media outlets do, because of the content of what they are publishing, is an offense to the First Amendment. It's offensive to anyone who believes in press freedom, and every single press outlet should stand in solidarity with them. Now, that's distinct from internal press criticisms of how WikiLeaks operates as a press outlet, in the same way that if the National Review came under attack from governments, from Visa, MasterCard, I would stand foursquare with them for them, you know, for their rights as a press outlet to not be impinged upon by those powers. And I can still say the columns in the National Review are terrible and odious. I don't think the content of what WikiLeaks is doing is terrible and odious, but I do think it's open to all sorts of criticisms that one would leverage, you know, press criticism in the same way that, you know, you may not like a certain cable show one night, or I might, you know what I mean? Like,
that's
people have very complicated, and I think it's not black and white about, you know, what they've chosen to leak and how they've chosen to do it. But the institutional attacks on WikiLeaks to me is black and white. That's a sort of line in the sand issue. And I think it's the duty of everyone, particularly who considers themselves a member of the Fourth Estate, whose livelihood is preserved and protected by the First Amendment, to stand in solidarity with WikiLeaks against these institutional attacks.
Chris Hayes, Washington editor of The Nation, thanks so much for sticking around. I know you got to run.
All right. That was really fun, man. Thanks.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. There you have it. I could actually talk to him all day, and it's actually I have the benefit of watching him on the camera.
It's true.
We're both sitting here like shaking our fists at the computer. So that's it. You know, I'm gonna try and find somebody that we can talk to, because I'm also interested, and I think, you know, I think what in my mind what Chris was saying about the WikiLeaks is somewhat obvious. I really didn't see the distinction between the New York Times or anybody else, frankly, and WikiLeaks. What is really interesting to me is what is happening in response to it. This sort of this anti-government vigilantism, because the idea that they can attack, you know, corporations in this way. I don't know. Very interesting stuff. And Assange, apparently, according to Newsweek, has data, and this is very strange to me, has the files of all the Guantanamo prisoners. I saw this via Newsweek. Now, my understanding is the information that this guy Manning passed on to WikiLeaks, the leaker, the actual leaker, Manning, 2.5 million people had access to. Why does 2.5 million people have access to the files of our Guantanamo prisoners? That seems just bizarre.
You know, I wonder how much of that's a function of how privatized we've made everything.
How privatized?
Yeah, you know, like what does Blackwater have access to, for instance, things like that.
Right. You know, that's the problem, is that at Guantanamo they were using the Amazon cloud servers. Do not keep, if you're the U.S. government and you are holding people in your gulag, do not use Blogger or WordPress as a way of... is it even worth me bringing up that story about that same guy from the AFIA who claims that this whole WikiLeaks is a function of Manning being gay? Is it even worth bringing up? It isn't. Well, fuck that guy. This is, you know, another one of those like right-wing retards who's, excuse me, when I say retard, I mean literally retard. He's like, he's socially and intellectually and culturally retarded. He's slowed down to a crawl, this guy.
trying to make a name for himself, you know, by writing stuff like this. I mean, it's the only way. And the thing is, he will be rewarded in that circles. Yeah. You know, there isn't the same incentive structure on the left as there is on the right. It just simply isn't. You know, if I was to take a similar position on the left, like, I don't know what the mirror position would be. It's almost impossible to even speak, because it's not just it is literally apples and oranges. It's not apples and not apples. I'd be ostracized. Even if I was getting huge hits, because that's all, you know. On the right, if you're financially successful, if you're getting eyeballs, you win. Period. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You can't go wrong there if you're doing that. You can lie. It doesn't matter. So, there is Chris Hayes' take on the tax deal. I'm very encouraged by the House Democrats standing up for this. I hope what they're holding out for is something more. I actually, you know, the more I think about this, the more I think that even on, look, it's impossible to calculate what the policy implications are going to be one way or another. That's the way I feel. We can look at this today and say, this is what I'm getting in my hand, and a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. But not if, all right, let's see how we can make this metaphor. Not if it's putting bird poison into the bush, right? A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. But we're not, this is not the trade, right? This is a bird in the hand is worth minus two birds in the bush. Forget about the bird in the hand. This is a hostage-taking scenario, and we're paying off the hostage-takers, but we're not just paying off the hostage-takers. You know, we're unlocking the keys to the house next door and saying, you thought these hostages were good. Next door, yes, I see that you've taken some women and men hostage in this house. Okay, here's your ransom. And what we're going to do is we're going to dig an underground tunnel for you to go into the house next door. And there's women and children in that one. And then we're going to dig another underground tunnel to the next house. Women, children, and puppies. Women, children, and puppies. And take those hostages with you. Or it's basically saying, like, we're going to build three or four underground tunnels. And you can only take those hostages two doors down, or reverse. You can't take the hostages for two doors. We're going to take them outside. We're going to walk them down the street. They'll be in the third house. And so you got to go through two tunnels to get there, but we'll see you in three houses, buddy. Right? Because the unemployment benefits run out in a year. The debt stealing stuff, I say, fuck it. I think Chris Hayes is absolutely right. You tell Nancy Pelosi marches over to Boehner. We heard you loud and clear. We're with the Tea Party. No raising the debt. All yours, guys. All yours. You're in charge now. You don't want to raise the debt ceiling? Don't do it. Don't do it. We're not in a position to affect this outcome. All the Republicans, you're in charge. Republicans are in charge. Let them take responsibility for the debt ceiling. I mean, honestly, that's what the Progressive Caucus should do, regardless. Forget it. Negotiate higher tax. Look, Chris Hayes is right. As offensive as it is on the estate tax, as offensive as it is extending Bush's tax cuts, and even the notion that they would be perennially or permanently cut in 2 years, I actually think the bigger problem is just that you're giving up all your leverage. You're just creating a dynamic that is just going to slowly chip away. And so you may be, you know, saving the hostages today, but in a year, they're all going to die.
Speaking of government overreach, while we have a minute or two, and I guess I'll talk about this tomorrow, but was I talking about Bloomberg yesterday?
A little bit.
I've actually, and you know what? This is what I wanted to talk to Hayes about, because he's a great person to have this conversation with, and I'm going to have him back next week, but about this conversation. You know, there's all this chatter about primarying Obama. And for the most part, I've sort of dismissed it as, first of all, it's just ridiculous. Like, I mean, who honestly is going to primary him? The other problem with the primary is that you talk about destroying the fabric of the Democratic Party. It's the race issue is an issue. You cannot, you know, you cannot escape the fact that primarying the first black president is a loaded proposition. It simply is. And, you know, I don't think that's illegitimate. I don't think that's an illegitimate concern. I don't think it's something that should be dismissed. I don't, you know, there are certain realities in this world. And I don't think, frankly, to the vast majority of Democrats, I saw some poll that said 80% of self-identified liberals think that are still very much supportive of Obama. You know, so this is not a the sentiments that I express, where I'm at in my frustration with Obama, is certainly not universally held by those who agree with me on many other policy issues. And, you know, understand that the people who listen to this podcast, simply by virtue of the numbers, simply by the virtue of, this is probably not the first time you've heard me, in the context of this podcast, you are incredibly savvy when it comes to politics. And you are aware of things that are going to play out, or the potential scenarios that are going to play out, months and months and months and months and months before the people you walk amongst with. You know, they're in the Matrix. They took whatever the pill is, you know. I'm not being judgmental. I'm just stating as fact. And so, in this context, you know, it is simply a reality that race would play into it and be very damaging to the Democratic Party in some respects. And of course, I don't think that there is a challenger out there who would beat Obama. I just don't think there is, and who would be willing to challenge Obama. I just don't think there is. Now, with that said, so for the most part, I've been contemplating a challenge to Obama as being rather quixotic, quixotic, however you want to pronounce that. I pronounced it both ways, so for those of you who aren't familiar with the pronunciation, and tie it into the way that the word is spelled. And, but I do think that the other argument is that, I mean, Bloomberg gave a speech yesterday, and I've been talking about, like, you know, what is the, last night I tweeted before I even saw any of this stuff, ... and essentially blank, and then hashtag the difference between Obama and Bloomberg. Now, don't get me wrong, you know, I'm not a big fan of Bloomberg's. I don't think we need more billionaires running for office, but, and I don't, I'm sympathetic, but I don't quite buy into the idea of, like, well, you know, at least it can't be bought by corporations. You know, the world in which he travels in is just all wealthy people, but I think he tried to take a subway to show that he knows where Queens is or whatever it was. But for the life of me, I can't see the difference policy-wise between Obama and Bloomberg. And this third way bullshit, it's all bullshit. I mean, you know, the idea that somehow he's going to be more functional than anybody else because he's not part of a party, that's just all, that's fantastical. But if the ship is going to sink in under one captain,
And there's reason to believe that it's going to sink under another captain in the same way. I would rather that captain not be associated with the party that I still feel, maybe deludedly, is still the best vehicle for progressive change down the road. I just haven't seen a better option. You know, it's simply a bus. And, you know, the Democratic Party is a bus. Where you drive it is, you know, fortunately the bus is not heading in the proper direction. But I'm looking around the bus and I'm saying that there's more progressives on this bus than there is on the Republican bus. And, you know, maybe if we're able to keep some people off the bus and get more progressives on the bus, and then we can bum rush the driver and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not that I have any sort of irrational feel to the Democratic Party, but I do think there is value in protecting its brand. And I think if Obama's ever going to move to the left, it's not because of a primary challenger. Heck, have Evan Bayh challenge Obama. I could get, you know, I would rather chop off my foot than have Evan Bayh as the Democratic nominee. But I do think that he could challenge Obama, maybe. Maybe not. He wouldn't be stupid enough to do that in the Democratic Party. But I think the idea of a Bloomberg running would force Obama to the left a little bit in a governance style. Now, you know, I don't know. You could argue that, like, big deal. He did that during the primary. I mean, Clinton, he ran to the left of Clinton. I don't think there's anybody who can deny that. My sense is he's governing more or less, at least from a policy perspective, exactly where Clinton would be. And, you know, granted, Bill Clinton rose taxes in 93. Obama is not, but, you know, it's a different economic situation, frankly. You wouldn't want to raise taxes across the board at that time. I mean, at this time, because we're still in the middle of a recession. And taxes on people below $250,000, maintaining those tax cuts does have a stimulative effect. So it's not the same climate, and I don't think that it's impossible to say, it's impossible to prove, but I don't think we would have been much better off with Clinton in this regard, other than the fact that perhaps wasn't part of her brand to capitulate in the same way, and maybe from a rhetorical standpoint we could have been in a better situation. I don't know. It's an impossible guess. But, shoot.
Do you think that Don't Ask, Don't Tell would be as big of a problem if she was president?
What do you mean, in terms of getting it passed?
Yeah. Do you think it would be as big of a deal?
I don't know. Maybe. Well, look. Bill Gates, Republican Secretary of Defense, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, there's nothing different. I mean, yes. Would Obama be? Is Obama pressured in the same way that Clinton? I don't know. Maybe it would make the difference. I don't know.
That's a big thing.
But I know that Bloomberg seems to be more to the left of Obama on gay rights. Bloomberg seems to be left of Obama on immigration reform, perhaps. But the DREAM Act passed in the House yesterday. It's in the Senate right now. Don't Ask, Don't Tell looks like it may happen. But all this is now a function of this tax deal, because the Republicans are going to hold this hostage, right? Dorsey, is that what you're about to say?
Plumline tweeted out about 10 minutes ago, bad. An informed Senate aide emails me this. Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. It appears that leadership is moving forward without votes. Without the votes, excuse me.
Because Susan Collins was holding this hostage because she wanted more amendments or whatever it was. You know, but listen, the day that I trust someone like Susan Collins or Lindsey Graham Guys, please. It's hard enough to get a decent sound in here. Will you shut that closet? Evan. The day that I trust people like Susan Collins or Olympia Snow or Lindsey Graham, please, guys. We just need a little more amendments, but that means that they're full of shit. Okay, that's what that means. They're full of shit. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. If you're a log cabin Republican at this point, seriously, I know you have reason to be frustrated with the Democrats. They haven't been aggressive about this. But, you know, 5 Republicans, that's all it would take, right? 4 Republicans? 2? 3? Give me a break. Give me a break. I've been talking about this story. I wanted to get to it for a long time. On Tuesday, a federal judge threw out a lawsuit aimed at preventing the United States from targeting the U.S.-born anti-American cleric Anwar al-Awlaki for death. Now, the AP writes U.S.-born. The fact is, he's a U.S. citizen. Which they get to, like, you know, 4 or 5 graphs now. He's a U.S. citizen. And the Obama administration has completely unilaterally, without any judicial review, asserted the right to assassinate this person because of some categorization. The AP, according to the AT, he was tied to last year's shooting at Fort Hood and the attempted bombing of U.S.-bound flight last Christmas. You know how he's tied to? He's tied to by news reports that say that these guys may or may not have listened to him on the internet. Tied to. Understand that our government now, the Obama administration, asserts the absolute authority to assassinate a U.S. citizen based on their YouTube videos. I'm being silent for dramatic effect here. This is where you take the time to go, what? Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure. Could they make the argument that, hey, this guy's that's bullshit YouTube videos are anti-American and is creating dissent? And so we need to assassinate him? I mean, I guess that's more of a function of my listeners, of the viewers, right? I mean, if you guys started doing bad things. So just,
high on a hill was a enjoy. Lonely goat herd, lay, hoddle-lay,
hoddle-lay.
The, loud was the voice of the lonely
go-to.
Goat herd, lay, hoddle-lay,
everything's gonna be fine, music.
Oh,
all right, folks, are we crossfade this with that? Looking into the sun?
Yeah.
Okay.
Here we go.
The prince on the bridge of a castle.
Is that we're gonna try and go out with some happy? All right, folks. Some happy music. I am on the other side. Sorry, I went long again today. Couldn't help it. Couldn't help it. Become a member, please, if you can. If you're a member, don't forget, special email address for you to send us your swag requests or Bush pardon video requests. You can check that out. If you non-members, I'll let you go to the become a member, pull down that menu and see what member benefits look like. You can take a look at it, but it's not for you when you become a member. All right, I am me at Majority FM right after the show. Sammy Cameron's in effect. See you tomorrow. Chris Rosen will be here. I noticed Chris Hayes stepped all over his Netflix streaming with that sneakers thing. All right. Talk to you tomorrow. I missed this from Josh when I was talking about the government putting all their stuff on WordPress and Turns out all government secrets, Mobile Me. They put it on Mobile Me. Shoot, I held Chris too long. He just saw an email from him. Oh, by the way, I need to be off by 12:15. Oops.
Oh, no.
Whoops. Oh, there you go. That's good job, Sam. Wait, he was probably going to a paid talk. He shows up late. He's going to get in trouble. Cranes are flying. First Adrian Gonzalez and now Carl Crawford. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Ooh, oh, but we managed to get Derek Jeter back. Oh. And Jeter's upset. He's going to start turning to the booze, start hanging out with Madonna again, or wherever. It was A-Rod. So maybe he'll start hanging out with Madonna now just to piss off A-Rod. It's looking good. Wait till next year. You notice how like I almost like slipped into like some like Massachusetts moron accent. The anonymous name is a little tongue-in-cheek. It's not really an organization. It's just kind of a banner assumed by people who agree with the cause. There's a message board called 4chan. Yes, no, I know. I know 4chan. I never say 4chan out loud because I'm always afraid of them coming after me. Like, I'm that sort of clueless as to 4chan. But they really mess some people up, 4chan.
Oh, yeah? If you I'm just like, how do they find these things out? You know, like just a person on a video that does something. That's the only clue that they have. And next thing you know, that person's life is a living hell.
Right. That's why I never talk about them.
Actually, there's a video on Mediaite. I tweeted it out from Anonymous.
Really?
A communique.
What does it say? There's no audio, right?
It's audio, but it's robot talk with some kind of cool international.
How long is it?
I think it's like 2 minutes.
Why don't you IM me and I could actually play it?
Sure.
The anonymous name is a little tongue in cheek. There's a message board called 4chan. Yes, that's like 4chan broke into. Somebody at 4chan broke into the Palin's emails. 4chan does all sorts of crazy stuff. That's where the campaign against Scientology began. There aren't anonymous meetings. I know there aren't. It's not an organization that meets like in a, you know, like, we are part of the French Resistance. We are meeting in the basement of a wine cellar. And, you know, no, it's not. I get that. I'm not that. 4chan is known as the birthplace for many internet memes. That's where Rickrolling happened, right? Is that where it started? Where did Rickrolling came from?
I mean, that's a YouTube thing.
That just happened. You know, it's like a natural force of nature.
D.D. Fru, thank you for getting Chris Hayes on that Building America Bonds thing. Greg Krugman today and Glad House Not Surrendering. Sneakers, watched it 6 times in the past month. You know, I've seen Sneakers. I think it's okay. It's not, you know, it doesn't touch, like, Redford's in that, right? It doesn't touch, you've never seen it, have you?
No.
It doesn't touch 3 Days of the Condor. Have you watched 3 Days of the Condor recently?
It's been. So I was like a kid.
Yeah.
Have to watch.
Let me tell you something. You want to freak yourself out? Watch 3 Days of the Condor, and count in how many frames, how many times in that movie you see the Twin Towers. It was essentially shot almost like on a pivot point with the Twin Towers. Like literally, it takes place in Manhattan. And in Brooklyn. And in the distance, you can see the Twin Towers as if it's like almost like the camera angle is on like a pivot, like on a string. Like you tied a string and went across like this.
They're always watching you.
Well, and it see where the CIA is housed, which is actually was accurate, and what it was about. I mean, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. This is a movie shot 27 years ago now, probably. Let's see, 80, 20. No, oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Oh, shit. Mm-hmm. 37.
Yeah.
Fuck. God damn it. I remember when using my big pencil to write 1971. God damn it, I'm getting old.
I sent it through GChat. I don't have my aim up.
My problem with even the stimulus portion of the compromise, says Sammy Cammer 1, is that to justify poison pill tax cuts, Obama gave the Republicans more tax cuts. That's the GOP equivalent of 72 virgins. Yes, I mean, that's my point. Is that, like, you know, if you kept coming up with bills saying, like, we want more tax cuts, we want more tax cuts when the Republicans are in the majority, like, you know, what are they going to do? Bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, but not if it's George W. Bush. I agree that Clinton would have put up at least a rhetorical fight. Hey, Doris, who was listening to news anchors, including Oberman, attempting to explain what anonymous is and what a DOS is. It means as hilarious to you was as it was for me. Hey, Dorsey. Okay, this is what Svengali says. Oh, folks, you know, Svengali says, dude, I'm going to check out your blog first thing in the morning. He's been posting so much, though, I haven't caught up. But he dealt with this thing that's going around, this video of the barstool economics, which was just a huge bunch of bullshit. I mean, but it starts with this basic premise of, like, taxes are like a $100 bar bill, and this is why somebody, you know, at the end it sort of justifies, like, you know, some guy going galt. Go to a Diary of a Mad Economist. Why not SvenGollySays.com? Hey, Dorsey, was listening to news anchors, including Oberman, attempting to explain what anonymous is and what a DOS means, as hilarious to you as it was for me. Well, Evan understands this stuff better than Dorsey, right?
Yeah, and unfortunately I did not get to watch Oberman last night.
There you go.
And I don't own a TV.
Ah, okay, good for you, Svengali says. MadEconomist.net. MadEconomist.net. That's so much easier. Good for you, Svengali says. Also, if you would be so kind to ask Dorsey or the dirty hippies listening, if there are any economic concept you don't understand and would like to learn more about, example, debt deficit and the ceiling. Warning, offensive joke. Anyone remember? Oh, okay. He's saying he wants the resolution for the hostage taking that happened with the Somali pirates, when the Somali pirates were all shot. You know, what we should do maybe, when, you know, we got to talk to, put this on the list of things to do. Put the Tumblr site, the Majority Reporters Tumblr site, on the back end of our site. And then maybe can we set up something like an Ask Svengali and then link to his blog?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a Kyle thing, right?
Right. We'll figure it out. Harold, Media Matters is, yes, I saw that story. I had that story. I was going to do it tomorrow. That Fox News' managing editor wanted people to say government option instead of public option. Just like, you know, I was hanging out at one of those government parks. you know, as opposed to the private parks. There's private parks and there's government parks. Central Park is a government park. Grand Canyon, government park. Disney World, private park. Yeah, it's just more neutral. It's just a more neutral. Public option was. They did polling. They found that people liked the public option. So it's unbelievable. Don, is that Chris Hayes? Yes. Hey, have you been listening to Randy Rhodes and her take on the tax deal? I haven't. What is hers? Let's go to the next person. This person claims they have friends in state who agree with Assange. Randy believes the deal was the best we can get. I mean, look, you know, I don't, you know, I think that there is, I don't think that the argument that this is the best we can get is an illegitimate argument. And it may be the best that we could get, but you know what? You have to believe that the Republicans are going to, when called on, are gonna walk away from unemployment. And, you know, these guys always overplay their hand. And the idea that they wouldn't extend unemployment benefits, I'm sorry. I just don't think they'll own it. At the end of the day, I don't think they'll own it. And you got to also calculate here as to, like, people, if you do not, you know, sort of fund the states, and if they defund everything else, the benefits are going to end up being net zero anyways. And if the idea that they keep cutting for unemployed and this and that prevents them from making further cuts, then you're at the same place with a political win. You know, I just, O'Donnell got so self-righteous about the extra 50% in income tax, which sounds a lot, you know, when you put it that way, sounds like a lot. But it's really saying is it's an extra maybe 5% from the poorest people's income, $40,000 or less. And I would say that probably only goes to, at one point you don't have to pay taxes. So it's the lowest income tax bracket. Talking about a maximum of $2,000 a year. Which it, I'm not diminishing the amount of money. We're talking $180. But you know, if you want to get that adamant, you should, you know, you, it's much worse if you're unemployed for 99 weeks and you have no unemployment insurance coming in. That's worse. That's just worse. The person who has to pay an extra $200 a month, they're going to cut out things. The person who loses their unemployment after 99 weeks, they're going to move into their car if they still have a car. And, you know, this is not to mention, like, you know, if you really can get that excised over the pain inflicted, and you know, look, there's still going to be more pain on those people. More is coming. It's not like okay, this, we make this tax deal and everything's going to be fine for those people. They, you know, we've insulated. No, you've insulated them for a very small period of time from only one attack by the Republicans. And all you're doing is empowering the Republicans to attack these people more. You know, so if you want to get that angry about something, why not get angry about the fact that we're still killing civilians in Afghanistan and spending that much money, you know, in the course of like 6 minutes? This is the argument I'm having in my head last night as I'm trying to go to sleep with Myla snoring next to me, because we had a leak in our in the roof of the apartment, and we're afraid that there's mold behind the walls in her room or on the floor. So Super's been very good about it. He came in and he like pulled up the floor, but then he put down new floor with like, you know, that polyurethane, and it stinks in her room, so she's sleeping in our bed. So I go to bed, and I'm like sitting here having this like sort of semi-obsessive argument with a guy I just saw on TV. And Miles is like, and then, you know, I have to position like the pillows so that she can't kick me. And then, like, it's, I don't know what it is about kids that age, but they have these involuntary things where they kick people. Like, literally, I almost thought about, like I got to try and turn the other side. And then I turn the other side, and I'm facing out the lights coming through the window. And Randy says Obama did the best that he could. Well, that may be true. He allowed himself to get into the position to get screwed. What the Dems should do is let the extensions. What the Dems could do, let the extension run out. The Dems could bring them up, let the Republicans publicly turn them down. Right? Well, yeah, but then you've hurt people. I mean, the Reverend Jay suggesting a legalized marijuana bubble to get us out of this economic woes. If 2.5 million people have access to something, it's not secret. Martin Mannion, you could talk to Chris Hayes all day. I could listen. He could probably explain the quantum theory, even the plot of Lost, to make total sense. Get more and get him on. Yeah, I know. I will. The people hurt worse below 40,000. Most likely they will probably won't have health care, so they get a tax there, and now this tax cut hurts them more again, so it's more than 200 a month. David Rodriguez, the people hurt worse is the below 40,000. Right, well, they lose their economic, their work credit. I've heard different things on that. It's gone back and forth. New York Times reports that they'll be worse off, but I've heard other people say that's not the case. As a negotiating tool, why not offer to raise taxes above 1 million to say 50% and then go from there? Why is there no campaign finance reform, filibuster reform? Right. You're right. I'm happy now. Excellent show. Thank you. The problem with trying to push Obama to the left, says Optimal Tomatoes, with a challenge to his right, is that Obama always assumes the left has nowhere to go other than him, and he'll be only a shade to the left of any opponent trying to split the middle. Fortunately, according to the numbers, he may be correct. Yes, well, you know, he'd have to move off where he is now pretty far to the left to be more left than Bloomberg. You know, and he can't move to the right of Bloomberg because he gets into what Bloomberg will do. I will tell you this now. You can listen to the people who say Bloomberg won't run because he won't run unless he's sure he can win. Well, Bloomberg knows that he can't be sure about winning until after the primaries. And here's the advantage that Bloomberg has. He's got a bucket load of money. And of his own money. And, you know, on a day like where, you know, some of these tycoons, these billionaires of 16 billionaires, multi-billionaires, billionaires, have offered to give away their money, or the majority of their money. I don't think Bloomberg's sitting there going like, yeah, if I'm going to give away half my money anyways, I might as well spend half of it right now to see if I can be the first Jewish president. And, you know, maybe he doesn't even think about being the first Jew. You know, he's probably just thinking like being president. And so he waits to see if Obama's primaried. Obama's primaried, he gets weakened. He waits to see if Sarah Palin will be the nominee. I got news for you. If Obama comes in and he's the nominee against Sarah Palin, and I'm Bloomberg, and I'm looking at either a primaried Obama from the left or primaried Obama from any point, or an anemic showing in the primary coming out. Because, you know, one of the things that helped Obama in the general election was that he had activated this entire network. And I look at and I start seeing like, oh, wow, he's considerably under. I mean, yes, it's a primary. But, you know, if his numbers, if Democratic turnout is, you know, in the primaries is like what it was in 2010. Because you're still going to have down ticket races, primaries. And I'm Bloomberg. And I'm seeing, you know, Sarah Palin. Or, you know, some really right winger running. And I'm Bloomberg. You know what I'm thinking? It's now or never. And I got, let's see, what would $100 million buy me a year out from the general? $100 million, day one, boom. That's without all his billionaire friends going like, hey, be glad to bundle for you.
And he wouldn't have to run in the primary.
I mean, how much did he spend in the New York mayoral race, right? $50 million?
Yeah.
Was it more?
I think it was more.
So this dude's not willing to drop 100. This dude's willing to drop like 200 or 300 million. And remember, we were all like, wow, Obama, and the entire time raised $500 million for small donations. You know, and they'll report it like Bloomberg. He raised a lot of small donations and one big one. One super big one.
Well, not even just himself. Like, he'll get all the backing of every corporation.
Maybe.
Oh, man.
Maybe.
Over Sarah Palin?
Over Sarah Palin? Yeah. That's right. That's why that story with Richard Wolff was so fascinating to me. As in the middle of talking to him about it, I realized, like, this is fascinating. They've already got the Tea Party trying to get rid of Palin. Palin scares. I'll tell you something. Don't anybody ever tell you anything different. Palin scares the Republicans far more than she scares the Democrats.
Oh yeah.
If it wasn't for Sarah Palin, frankly, and this whole, you know, that whole movement, Obama would be far less enabled to be like this than he is. That's the thing that makes him, that enables him. Optimal Tomatoes, the real benefit of a primary challenge may be to find both a Dean's challenge, Obama's agenda in debates, and hopefully convey to the masses that Obama's driving doesn't represent the Democratic bus service. Yeah, I guess. Maybe. Doubt it. Majority Fuller, my major concern about membership, my membership, is when you use the extra support to move from a $1 lunch to a $2 lunch. You become like Jon Stewart, and your staff creates around you a $2 lunch bubble. Then the show changes to only address the $2 lunch crowd and isolate us $1 lunch people. If this happens, do you have a plan to maintain your connection to the $1 lunch crowd, like eating $1 lunch once a week? Just in, CIA has taken out a hamster on a piano. I don't know what that means. Do you know what that means? It's that video. Right, okay. I got news for you. It is going to be a while before we get out of the $1 lunch crowd. But that's right. I mean, I do want to keep my connection to that $1.
There's not much difference between the $1 lunch and the $2 lunch. It's just, you know.
It's just a different pizza place, two blocks.
No, it just means you get two slices.
That's right.
I'll tell you, the $1 pizza slice, that's a good slice of pizza. It's as good as any other. Honestly,
for a dollar, yes.
No, but forget about the dollar.
It's pretty good. A lot of garlic in that sauce. I just wish they'd.
Listen, I go to places. I can get like a $3. I get a $3 slice. It'd be not as good as that.
Yeah,
definitely.
It's good. It's a good slice. If I paid $2.50 for that slice or $2.25, I wouldn't go like, God, I can't believe I just paid $2 for this slice. Can't. The burgers, I won't touch that.
No,
way.
And I'm not even interested in the coffee there.
No.
No, yeah, I don't trust it.
Don't be a putz. Sorry for the sports analogy, but advising the Dems is like telling the Washington Generals to take it to the hoop. Democrats' role is to lose to the Republicans. That's how they keep their jobs, which is really the only thing they care about. Why else would Lieberman or Spector so easily become Republicans and Joe Manchin was the friggin' VP candidate 6 years ago? Well, look. I don't agree with that. I just don't agree with that. I mean, Joe Manchin was the friggin' VP candidate 6 years ago because Al Gore's somebody told Al Gore that he had to respond to the moral indignation of the American public, which did not exist, over the fact that Bill Clinton got a blowjob from somebody who wasn't his wife. And the biggest moral scold at that time. The one who got onto the Senate floor and blah, 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 about Bill Clinton was Joe Lieberman. And the Democrats knew Florida was going to be a problem. They thought that Joe would help them in Florida, as if the Democrats don't in Florida, the Jews in Florida don't vote overwhelmingly for Democrats all the time. They even did it for Obama, even after all the bullshit. And I got news for you. I love her. She got a lot of hits, but it wasn't because Sarah Silverman's great schlep that the grandparents voted for Obama down there. It's just because Jews are the number two most consistent Democratic voting bloc in the country after black people. Period. So you didn't need Joe Lieberman for Florida. You needed him so he could God, I've always had a problem with Joe Lieberman. I remember him when I was in Connecticut at college. I went to college in Connecticut in 1980, from 84 to 88. And they got rid of the, I would drive from Worcester down to New London, where I went to college. And they had tolls, but they got rid of the tolls at one point. And next thing I know, like 12:30 in the morning, you know, I'm probably inebriated in some form or another, particularly in those early days. Watching Letterman, and effing Joe Lieberman comes on an ad taking credit for the frickin' tolls being gone. He was attorney general, for God's sakes. Deirdre Mathenth, what do you think about the best 2012 primary challenger? Howard Dean? No. Jerry Brown? No. Elliot Spitzer? No. Al Sharpton? None of the above. What do you think of Jerry Brown as a primary challenger? He's inexperienced? No.
No.
No. No. No. No. If you're going to be, if you're going to challenge Obama, it should come from somebody like completely that I would not be terribly excited about. Like I say, the only primary challenge scenario is one that it emboldens Bloomberg. That's the only way that pushes Obama. The other day, someone wondered about using reconciliation to pass middle-class tax cuts. I've heard other pundits bring up. Randy Rhodes had said that would not work because it would not be deficit neutral, which it has to be to use reconciliation. She is pushing the idea that Obama's done a good job of making the best of a bad situation. She has made some good points, but she has left out some of the contrary details. You've done a good job of pointing out. It does need to be deficit neutral, is my understanding, but if you were to maintain the tax cuts as they are now under the extension, I don't know. It's an argument. I don't know. Because you're only talking about you're extending tax cuts. You're not adding any new tax cuts. The tax cuts that are in there are extensions of ones from the stimulus. So you don't extend the millionaire's tax cuts and you offset unemployment insurance with that. Boop, boop. I don't know if that works out. Boop, boop. Just in Daily Kos, Reuters, Pelosi will not hold vote. Oh, here we go. Oh, well, we heard this already. But wow, wow, wow. This goes even further than what Chris Hayes told us. Reuters announcing Pelosi will not will not bring Obama's current proposed tax plan up for a vote in her chamber. I need like a take that, man. That's why you're happy that she's, and I got news for you, standing Hoyer, no freaking way.
Mm-mm.
That's why we're happy. While this doesn't necessarily scuttle the whole tax deal, it's unlikely the tax good. Oh boy, I can't. I'm gonna have to watch O'Donnell tonight, though. He was like, "This is going to pass," and Grayson was like, "I wouldn't be so sure." I mean, it probably will in some fashion. My guess is, but who knows?
It's
not a done deal.
Last time I saw Grayson on MSNBC, he was on Hardball, and it was back during the healthcare things. And like, Matthews was like, "Healthcare's not going to pass," basically just like telling it to his face. He's
right.
Like, how
right.
do you know?
Right. I remember specifically that.
It was awesome.
She's made some good points. She left out some of the contrary deal. Okay, let's race through these because I got to go. I just want you to know, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, I'll listen. Oh, thank you, Sandy McGee. Sandy. Shoot. Hi, Johnny. Oh, and Sandy, thank you for becoming a member. Hi, Johnny. Hey, Sandy. Hey, as a fellow member of the Chosen People, can I get a special discount to the Majority Report membership? I'll tell you what I'm going to do for Jews, and Jews only. I will give you a discount to the Cedar membership.
If you become a Cedar member, which is what is the Cedar member valued at today?
Because we actually $1,000.
Yeah, it's $1,000 a month. Now this is on. Understand that this is a brokered on the market. So this can this the $1,000. Some days it could be worth $1,025. Some days it could be worth $9,075. But if you become a Cedar member, $975. If you become a Cedar member, email me. We'll work out a special Jew discount. And I want to know. I want you to know that this discount would also probably apply to Christians, Hindus, Muslims, Wiccans, agnostics, atheists, Manichaeans, Buddhist. Did I say Buddhist already?
Yeah, but you can
Zen and, you know, Shinto Buddhists and Shinto and Shabbateans and
Confucians.
What's that? Spaghetti monster guys. you know, you zippy heads or whatever it is. Church of the Science of Intelligent Geniuses or wherever. All you guys. So just email me after you've signed up for the. Hi, Johnny. I'll have to drop out of college to join the Cedar level. Well, listen, we all got to make choices. Travoli 76, quiet fan since 2000, and now a member. Gay Republicans know some, even dated one. Gays can be jerks just like straights. Well, it's not so much that you're a jerk, it's just like you're actively enhancing the power of a party that explicitly treats you like a second-class citizen. I just don't understand that. You know, like, if you're black, at least you can maybe kid yourself if you don't, like, sort of, you know, parse the words that the electoral strategy by Republicans is geared towards, you know, is pivoted on you. But if you're gay, it's almost like you can't even, how do you even kid yourself? Well, my taxes will be lower. Well, they should be lower. You should actually, if you're gay, you should actually get another 25% discount for not being a full citizen. I'm a probationary member of the club, of the citizenry. I'm like, I don't have full citizenship. I get 7/8 citizenship, so I don't have to pay full taxes. That would make sense. J. David Lara, what's even spookier, in the last scene of 3 Days of Condo was on the block, the Majority Report broadcast from. That's actually true. Actually, it's not quite on the block, but the last scene is up there. What will you do? You can tell them a story, but what will you do? That's the guy from the AT&T commercials, Cliff Robertson. I guess I'm even dating myself when I say he was on the AT&T commercial.
Yeah,
yeah. Dorsey just looks at me like, wow, man, I didn't realize that you were like that old.
I totally forgot about AT&T commercials before they were.
But the end... Phone. Well, I'm not going to ruin the movie for anybody. Have you compared your listenership ratings to your last show at BRL? Well, you know, one of the dumb things about BRL was that we barely had any stats. Like, we were across so many different platforms. Like, I never, ever found out if anybody ever podcast us, if we were on iTunes. But, yes, we're doing better than BRL. Because BRL was impossible to watch. Because, one, you had to watch it, right? You couldn't listen to it because it was so visually specific. I would say 25% of the time we never started on time. We had technical difficulties. It was very difficult to watch. Yes, we're beating BRL quite handily at this point. Marin, relative to BRL, it's crazy break room life. God, we're going way too long. Did you see your friend Lawrence is comparing liberals complaining about tax gave to Pat Buchanan? Complaining about George W. Bush. Pfluger, swag selections. The membership benefits webpage has a typo regarding what you want people to conclude. If you put anything that relatively says swag or with a C, the A is missing. Oh, you got to fix that. Jimmy.
Was intentional.
No. Sammy, I think Obama Analyzation Nation is spinning its wheels. A good old-fashioned derisive mockery of Bon Air and Friends. Aren't there any foot-tapping pedophiles, meth-snorting evangelists to talk about? Obama's not crazy. Woo. Reefer cake. That's from Johnny Reefer Cake, so I didn't understand that either. But from Bob in Vegas, it's DDoS attack, dedicated denial of service. Not that I would know. We have to keep this frame as a Republican bill created in a Republican Congress. Yes, I agree, says Rusty Cole. Facebook and Twitter just confirmed they're deleting accounts about Anonymous and 4chan. You can guess which sites they will target next. Huh.
Wait a minute, they're deleting people's Facebook accounts?
Or messages.
Yeah, that's like, how do you, I got the story from, I'll look it up. How do you, like,
if you're Facebook, you own everything anyone ever posts to you through your really.
Evan By Hoover. Lawrence O'Donnell has done two great shows in a row. Let's kick them hippies some more. Turk Zone. If we're stuck with Obama or Republican, we might as well give up and move to Canada. Should be clear by now that Obama has his own agenda. Palin is leading the delegate count by June of 2012. It does not matter if Obama gets a primary challenge. Obama cannot win against Bloomberg. Gulfstream 2. It's madeconomist.com, not net. Svengali, are you drinking now? Svengali said it was madeconomist.net. I'll look at both. Dane Cook, the man. I've been driven to the point where I could recommend people give their money to Mark Maron before they give it to Obama. Re-election campaign. Of course, the best use of your money would be to become a Majority Report member to help build the juggernaut! Bill O'Reilly won. Kind of liked it at Lawrence O'Donnell. Good to see another Irish jackass on TV. Oh, boy. This is going to get me in trouble. And he can come in late and not worry about the whole early state process. According to Bloomberg. Big Ed Schlitz, you did a nice job the other night as my lead-in. Thank you. Look, I don't think it's attributable to me, but I did get emails from producers, and somebody tweeted, if you go to Mediate, I won the night. Everybody on MSNBC and CNN and Headline News. Not Fox, but I can't, honestly, I'm not being humble here. Because I would, if I really believed it was me, I would say it. I think I was helped by the tax deal. I think that was a big bump. Now, that doesn't explain why people went down with it. I didn't drive people away. Let's put it that way. I wasn't offensive enough to drive people away. That's the way I look at it. And that's good because I, you know, listen, you got to pull me some transcripts because I got to practice doing the teleprompter. I've got to get better. There's no way that they would have me back to do that show if I continue to function like that. But fortunately, that tax deal came through. I wasn't offensive enough to keep people away, and I have the opportunity to get better, and I will have another opportunity to fill in. I will know when soon. Stay tuned. But I will have another opportunity, and fortunately, my performance was not enough to be offensive and drive people away. I honestly believe that. I'm not being humble. I need to learn. There's a craft and a skill to that I have yet to develop. Torresy 80, longtime listener, current member. And I can say without a doubt the most commonly used word in the history of the Majority Report is notion. I would have to say that, like, if you took away the word notion, frankly, you know, be that as it may.
Yeah, that's a big one.
If you took away those phrases or words, there'd be nothing left here, folks, behind this microphone beyond a 5 o'clock shadow. Shanks Oft. Your girlfriend is a camel? Dude. I was very close. I don't want to brag here, but very close to being the only back-to-back student government president in a long time at Connecticut College. I lost as a sophomore, running for my junior year by 12 votes.
But I was class president, and I was still the president my senior year. Can't tell you how buzzed I was on... It was early in the day. It was in the morning. They had the trustees meeting to talk about divestiture from South Africa on the same day as the spring fling. So I go in there, and I'm a little bit buzzed. I didn't start hitting it hard till afterwards. But I gave a speech in front of this big, I don't know, 40 members of the Board of Trustees. The chair was the CEO of Pfizer at the time. After my speech, I basically said, the gist of it was, it's hard for me to remember, but I'll talk about this. This is a good story for tomorrow. Remind me tomorrow, because we don't have time. A good guy-girl ratio there tomorrow. Kevin semicolon. Be that as it may, we want pictures of your dollar lunches. We'll do that today, because I'm going to treat, although I need to go to the bank machine, if you can believe it. Don't forget, be that as it may, and at the end of the day. I already said it, but you're going to get one of these just for being such a dedicated listener that you know all the time. And that one's for you, John. That is for you, John, for joining. A bunch of people wrote, be that as it may. All right, folks, see you tomorrow. Check out, if you're a member, check out your email, and bye. To get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my power